From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the program, we learn about an effort to find a bacteria that can kill zebra and quagga mussels on the Great Lakes. Then a major exhibit at the Milwaukee Art Museum spotlights what we might not think of as art, things like duck decoys.
So yes, they were functional objects, but they were collected by collectors who were looking at these things as sculptural forms. And that's what happens throughout this exhibition.
And a Milwaukee writer's latest book is a guide to some of the best fantasy novels for both children and adults.
Someone said that fantasy was the original fiction. It used to be all fiction was fantasy and had this mythological impact and significance. And, you know, maybe other fiction has gotten lighter while fantasy has kept its depth.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for being with us this morning. The quagga mussel only entered the Great Lakes in the last quarter century, but it did not take long for the invasive species, which got here through ballast water from ocean-going ships, to overspread and often dominate the ecosystem here. But the work of a biologist in New York State may have added to the arsenal available to go after these invasives. Daniel Malloy discovered a bacterium that kills quagga and zebra mussels. Dr. Malloy, at the time based at the New York State Museum, led an international team that, after much trial and error, came up with a solution which is now commercialized. This is not Malloy's first scientific conquest. That centered on out-of-control black flies in the Adirondacks. He spoke by phone with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz and talked about how his boyhood summers spent on a lake in New Jersey informed the work he does today.
I just spent most of my time in that water with my little snorkel and my little fins, and I just got a tremendous appreciation for the wonders of what's going on biologically in lakes. So when I proceeded ahead with my education, I kind of was interested in aquatic biology. And then when I went for my doctorate, the New York State Museum was looking for someone to work on this problem that no one thought there would be a solution to, frankly. Could you use biological control to control black flies that are biting people in our state of New York? We have the Adirondack Mountains. And since tourism is one of the major industries in the Adirondacks, it's a pretty important thing to try to control them. And back in the 50s and 60s, planes were just flying, spraying stuff out to kill the adult black fly. So the New York State Museum, in the 70s, when I was doing my doctoral research, said, look, Dan, why don't you tackle this problem? And again, a lot of people said, you'll never find anything. But as it turned out, after 10 years working now, and this is very important because I didn't do this alone, working with an international team of scientists, we received our funding primarily from the World Health Organization, which is part of the United Nations. And the reason for that, not in North America, but in the tropics, black flies spread the disease of blindness. It's a parasite that they carry. It doesn't happen in North America. So internationally, I work with about a half dozen scientists, and we came up with a way to control black flies. But it wasn't by spraying anything out of airplanes. It was by putting a bacterium, not one, but literally millions, into streams and rivers where the black flies breed as larvae, and then they pupate under the water and they fly out to bite people. So it's one of these spectacular successes of biological control worldwide. It goes by the acronym BTI because it's Bacillus thuringiensis israelensis. So it's a tremendous success ever since it was commercialized by companies in the 80s, been used throughout North America and the rest of the world for black fly control.
So I don't want to beat the black fly to death, but when controlled, are they a normal part of ecosystems?
It's a very, very good question, and we actually have investigated this in our research because I'm an environmentalist, and we didn't want to introduce something to control black flies, then find out black flies are critically important in the ecosystem. Anytime, let me just preface it by saying, anytime you remove something from an ecosystem, there will be repercussions. Some of them could be positive. Some of them could be negative. So if you remove black flies, there will be a ripple effect in an ecosystem. The question is, how important and how damaging to the ecosystem is it? So we did a study in New York. We took all the black flies out of a stream for 2 years. We constantly treated with this biocontrol agent, which is incredibly specific, and we just kept treating and treating and treating so there'd be no black flies in that water. And we were surprised to find out that we couldn't find any major ecological ramifications from that. It was kind of a shock to us. So if someone tells you that, oh, you can remove black flies and it won't have ecological consequences, that's not true. But in our study, at least, we didn't find any serious ones to the stream ecosystem.
Interesting. So now the quagga and the zebra mussel are a whole different story. They don't belong in our waters.
Yeah, they don't belong in our waters. You know, there's nothing in life that just has negative consequences.
Okay, so what's the positive of these guys?
Well, these guys, they love to filter the water and remove particles. So even though they're the size of your fingernail, when they filter, a zebra mussel or a quagga mussel the size of your thumbnail can filter 1 liter of water a day. When you get billions of them in a water body, what they do is they clear the water. So all of a sudden, people say, hey, this is wonderful. Sure, my kids are cutting their feet on the shell when they go into the lake. But you know, the water's getting clearer. This is kind of pretty. Scuba divers, for example, may look at that clarity and say, this is a positive thing. However,
they're eating up the phytoplankton.
Oh, yes. They're eating up the phytoplankton. And therefore, that is the foundation of the food web in a water body. There are fish, larval fish, that eat phytoplankton or eat zooplankton, which depend on the phytoplankton. So you get this cascading trophic effect in water body. They call zebra mussels and quagga mussels ecosystem engineers, that when they come in, they change the dynamics of the ecology of the water body they're in.
And they're impacting power plants and clogging up.
Yeah. See, that's why I got involved in this research. In 1990, someone from here in New York, it's called the Department of Environmental Conservation, came to me and said, Dan, you know, you worked on black flies. We worked, you know, as colleagues, in a sense, on this development of a biological control agent for black flies. Do you ever think of working on a way to control zebra and quagga mussels, because they've come into our power plants in New York State, and those power plants have no defense except putting some pretty broad spectrum chemicals designed for cleaning out anything in the pipes. You ever think of working on coming up with a biocontrol agent that could be used by the power industry? See, so that's actually how I got started, and it was the power industry. They gave us like $700,000-$800,000 to get started on this. A lot of people, again, called it like some sort of a fishing trip here, and a waste of money, to find a bacterium that would control zebra and quagga mussels. I didn't, you know, commercialize it. That's a company in California. But my lab did all the work, hypothesized that there was a bacterium somewhere out there in water that had nothing to do. This is the thing that a lot of people don't understand. This bacterium, which is being commercialized under the product name Zequinox, this bacterium has nothing to do with zebra or quagga mussels. It just, by serendipity, by luck, these bacterial cells have some sort of a natural product a biochemical inside that cell, which when they eat the bacterial cell, live or dead, doesn't matter, that chemical kills the brain quagga muscles. So I hypothesized that in 1991.
So it started with a hypothesis, and then you went through 700 or more different strains of...
Yep.
Can you describe how you worked through that process?
Yep. We said we would find a bacterium that would kill zebra mussels, and even more than that, would be very specific. And the way we approached that is we went out into the environment and collected bacteria. You know, you can imagine a little petri plate with agar in it.
Right.
We isolated bacteria. It didn't matter basically where we were isolating them from, but we kind of did a lot of work in mud and rivers. And then we also contacted colleagues who have what you call libraries of bacterial cultures. So the vast majority of the things we tested were from colleagues of mine who would send 40 or 50 different types of bacteria and imagine a little powder, and we would grow it. If that powder would represent, you know, the bacteria that they sent us, and we would grow it up and we would test it. And it was really extremely frustrating because it took 4 years, January of 1995, that we found a bacterium. And there's one guy in particular who deserves a lot of credit. His name is John Holzapfel, and he's with the utility industries. He's recently retired. Because I went to him. We had tested out about 650 strains that did not kill zebra mussels. And I said to John, maybe you want to cancel our project, take your money back. And no, he said, Dan, you go back to your lab. Again, this is November 1994. You go back to your lab and you keep looking. 2 months later, we found it. It's one of those incredible stories that people will think I'm exaggerating. No. So that's how we found it, by getting bacterial strains from colleagues, and we grow up the bacteria, feed the zebra mussels, and also we would take environmental samples. And it was one of these environmental samples that proved to have this strain of a species called Pseudomonas fluorescens that kills zebra and quagga mussels.
Where did you find it, or are you not able to tell us?
Yeah, I can't. That's kind
Darn!
Of proprietary.
That's so exciting.
That's kind of proprietary information, but we generalize and say it's from a North American river, the mud
of
a North American river. Yeah. The river didn't have zebra mussels. This has nothing to do with zebra mussels. It's just serendipity that when they eat it, they die.
Wow. To make the Wisconsin link, one of the places that you tested out was a river in Wisconsin.
Yeah. What happened is we got a grant from the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. It was for supporting this kind of research. The grant was a 3-year grant. And after 1 year, I left the State Museum. I retired and came here to the University of Albany. And I handed off that grant to Dr. Denise Mayer at the New York State Museum. I didn't take the grant with me. I left it behind. And the reason I'm telling you this is that's the grant that has funded work in Wisconsin. But I basically passed the baton to Denise and USGS colleagues, and they have done that work. You see, so I don't want to take credit for that work. I got the grant along with Denise Mayer. She was the co-investigator on it. And then they, in 2012, 2013, and even this year, they're carrying that baton now and doing these field trials.
Dr. Daniel Malloy now carries out his research at the State University of New York at Albany's Department of Biological Sciences. He's also scientist emeritus at the New York State Museum. He spoke with Susan Bentz. Malloy is currently working to fight a lethal parasite plaguing the commercial bivalve industry, things like oysters, around the world. There's a link to a recent New York Times article about his work at wuwm.com/lake effect. We'll take a break now and then learn about a new exhibition based on a long-standing and huge collection of folk art at the Milwaukee Art Museum. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. What do duck decoys, quilts, and oil paintings have in common? They and many other examples of folk art are part of a major exhibit of American art on display at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Uncommon Folk features the range of things you might or might not normally think of as art. The museum most certainly does think of it as art. It began collecting this stuff many, many years ago and has amassed quite a collection, including art from a number of Wisconsin artists. Margaret Andera is the curator of the exhibit, which is open through May 4th. She tells Lake Effect's Bonnie North what makes art informed by self-taught and folk traditions different from that of classically trained artists.
When you go to a museum, most people expect to see work by artists who were trained in academic traditions, painting, sculpture, textiles, drawing. Most of those artists, especially contemporary or modern artists, have gone through art school. But there is a tradition, not just in this country, but everywhere, of artists who are either trained in different traditions that is not through art school, but through almost like community training. It's part of their life wherever they live, wherever they happen to live. It may be based on their religion. It may be based on their geography. And then there are artists who have no training, who come to the creative process and make extraordinary things. And so those latter two groups, the folk and the self-taught artists, are artists that the Milwaukee Art Museum has been dedicated to collecting since 1951. And that's unusual for a general art museum that also collects the work of trained artists, academically trained artists.
Why the interest in those groups of artists? What do they bring to the table that an artist in that more traditional training scenario doesn't?
It's interesting because at first, when this genre first sort of hit museums, it was about what made it different. But the fact that so many of these artists have been brought to the museum's attention through trained artists, I think the question really is, how are they so similar? How do artists who maybe weren't academically trained arrive at similar aesthetic details and ideas? I mean, yes, you can tell that perhaps an untrained artist isn't painting with perspective, with proper perspective. But that is a bad thing if what you want is to look at something painted with perfect perspective. But perhaps when it's not painted with perfect perspective, it allows you to see other things and it allows you to look at something in a different way. So I think the history of this material really being these artists being discovered by trained artists, the trained artists who look at this material, I think they see a freedom in some of the work, especially in the self-taught artists' work, because these are artists who were, you know, not only operating outside of the mainstream art world, but they weren't necessarily aware of the mainstream art world. And then within folk and self-taught, I mean, the way that I – and this is a minefield. The language around this field is really difficult, and people disagree on what labels. But in my mind, the difference between a folk artist and a self-taught artist is that self-taught I take very literally. These are artists who had never been taught how to paint, sculpt, do whatever. Folk artists, I think, are artists who are working within some sort of a tradition, whether it's a carving tradition or there are drawing traditions that started on the East Coast, the Fraktur drawings that came from German immigrants, quilting traditions, the G's Bend quilters in Alabama. They are folk artists. They are 21st century folk artists, but they are artists who are trained in a certain way of art making that isn't taught through art school. It's taught in their own communities.
So when you put those two things together in an exhibition like this one, how do they illuminate each other?
I think it's interesting because I think in some ways you don't see a difference.
And I think ultimately that's kind of what I see in this field, because I also work with contemporary art. And to me, I'm starting to see less and less of the differences and more of the similarities. And so, you know, this exhibition is our way of, first of all, showing off. I mean, I'll be blunt. It's a way of us to show off this amazing collection that we have. And the exhibition features the American folk and self-taught artists in our collection. And so when you look at them together, I don't know that you could necessarily say who might be self-taught, who was working within a tradition, except to say that perhaps, you know, a quilt is a traditional form of folk art. But when you look at portraiture, I think there's a fine line. I think in some ways it's not necessarily clear.
When you put this exhibition together, we have to say it's huge.
It's huge.
There are a lot of pieces and moving parts, literally and figuratively, in this exhibition. How did you select? Obviously, you made the selection to make it American.
Right.
But from there, how did you put it together?
Well, what I really wanted to do is to highlight the strengths of our collection, and we have a lot of strengths in the collection, and I thought it was going to be easy. I've worked with this collection for a very long time, and so I know the collection really well, and I thought I was going to – the selection was going to sort of unfold in front of me because it was going to be clear. I didn't realize how deep this collection went. And so I had to make decisions about things that told a story that was kind of interesting, yet also where we could show the collection and show examples of certain things in depth. And so I had to cut things out, like weather vanes, for instance, and face jugs. And so the way that I made selections was really where we had great depth, like portraiture. We have an amazing collection of 19th and 20th century and into the 21st century folk and self-taught portraiture. And so I chose things that lived together happily and that even across a century could have a conversation one with another. And again, what you see, the way the exhibition is laid out, is really how things, yes, materials have changed over the century, but there are so many similarities between 19th and 20th century portraiture. Again, with these artists who weren't necessarily working within the guidelines of what a portrait is supposed to look like, but they arrive at a similar aesthetic ending, and that's the part that interests me the most.
Yeah, they come to the same place eventually.
They do.
It's just an interesting, circuitous way.
They come from such different – they travel such different – roads to get there.
So you have portraiture as one mm-hmm. example. Another one, and I know this has gotten some publicity because it's just so perfect for Wisconsin, the duck decoys.
Yes.
You know, we think about duck decoys as something very practical, mm-hmm. not really an art object, but yet they are.
Well, they are. And we wanted to take care in this installation to be able to show these objects off in their best light. A lot of these things have been on view in the galleries, in the permanent collection galleries, for a while. But we wanted to show them in a way that either put them with more objects that are like them to kind of contextualize them a little bit more, or show them at a different vantage point. And when you mentioned the duck decoys, the decoys are all installed on these shelves against a wall, and there's a particular pair of these decoys that are flat. They're flat-backed birds. That's actually part of their actual names. And as sculptures, they're absolutely stunning shapes. And so I put them on lower shelves because even somebody short like me can get the proper vantage point of looking down on them, like sort of looking on top and looking down on them. So yes, they were functional objects, but they were collected by collectors who were looking at these things as sculptural forms. And that's what happens throughout this exhibition with functional objects like duck decoys, or there are trade signs, you know, advertising signs that were meant to convey the purpose of a store or a shop, but that are done with such artistic intention and flair that you can't ignore the fact that there are artistic aesthetic decisions being made in these things and that go beyond just the simple function of the object.
What I find interesting is that you look at some of this in the exhibition and you think, well, that's kind of one step removed from collectibles. Mm-hmm. And that people collect not necessarily thinking of them as art,
right,
but as, you know, just something fun to have. Oh, I've got a collection of signs. I know a lot of people who collect things like that. Right. And for you, what elevates something from a collectible to something that has that artistic intent?
I think the end product, it is something that, you know, when you look at art, there are paintings by trained academic painters who I think are museum worthy, and that same painter has painted things that aren't. That doesn't mean they necessarily don't end up in a museum anyway. But so I think what this material does in a lot of ways is it broadens the definition. It's just like you said, you know, you may not have thought of these things as art. But if they have a form or a shape that is interesting and has artistic intent that pushes boundaries the same way that a sculpture would, that somehow there are, you know, there's a sculpture that I'm thinking of particularly in the exhibition that is an illustration of the Bible, essentially. And the way that that sculptor, that carver, has told a story in such simple, simple forms. It's brilliance with its economy. It's a brilliantly economic sculpture that I think so many artists are after, that kind of, how can I get my message across without having to do too much? And that's a skill. And there are artists who in this exhibition who do that really well. So something from, you know, is it a collectible? One could argue that prints are a collectible because they're made in editions. So I think what this material does, and it's why sometimes, you know, people are uncomfortable with it. A lot of general museums weren't collecting this art in the very beginning when this first came on the scene, because it does push the definition of art. But as the world gets so much smaller and influences are coming from everywhere, I think we have to be open to broadening the definition.
Okay, I'm going to put you on the spot and ask you your favorite piece in this.
The work that I was just talking about, the Edgar Tolson Fall of Man sculpture. And for the reasons that I just said, when I give tours through the exhibition, I say, if aliens landed on Earth today and said, tell me what is sculpture, show me an example of sculpture, you could take, it's a series of eight works in this Fall of Man series. And the last work is where it's called Cain Going Out into the World. And the sculpture, it's a small square sculpture that has the slain Abel, and Eve is bent over grieving her dead son. And Cain is on the opposite part of this square, and his back is to his mother and slain brother, and he's about to like go out into the world. It's like the beginning of the rest of the story. And it's three figures carved out of poplar wood. So the wood is untreated except for the clothing on the figures. There's black paint. But the way that the expressions, the way that Cain's body is positioned in the corner of this one block of wood that everything was carved from, it kind of says it all. And it's done in such a simple way. It's not hitting you over the head with it. It's the message is you just sort of come to it. It's an easy sort of arrival as you come to this and you think, oh, I understand this. And yet it leaves you with this question, like, and now what's going to happen? And there are all these little subtleties that the artist has done. He's got boots on Cain as he's about to step out of Eden and go. To me, that's my favorite work. And it's a work that people respond to a lot. And a lot of artists that have come through the exhibition, everybody always stops at that one.
It is pretty intense. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful series. Mm-hmm. And even if you don't know that story, you know the story you've seen it.
Exactly. And again, it's not like it's got text explaining it. I mean, we put nothing. I purposely didn't put any explanation of that work. There are the titles of each of the sculptures, but you certainly understand it.
Well, Margaret, it has been such a pleasure, as always, to have you in the studio. Thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Uncommon Folk Traditions in American Art is on display at the Milwaukee Art Museum through May 4th. Margaret Andera curates the exhibit, and she spoke with Bonnie North. You can see pictures of some of what's on display at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. A new book by a Milwaukee writer offers a guide to remarkable and timeless fantasy novels for children and adults. We'll hear about some of them when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Teich. Every year, awards like the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award honor what many people think of as serious fiction. Weighty titles wrestling with weighty issues in a way that's sometimes accessible, sometimes less so. It's rare to find fantasy titles in the category of those so honored, but Milwaukee writer Philip Martin would urge you not to overlook the genre or think of it as frivolous. Martin's new book is called The Purpose of Fantasy, a reader's guide to 12 selected books with good values and spiritual depth, and he's with us now to talk about some of those books. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Mitch.
The title of the book is The Purpose of Fantasy. Let me take a riff off of that title and ask you what the purpose of this book is. What are you hoping to accomplish? Who are you hoping to reach?
The working title for the book was actually something like 12 fantasy books to read that will make you a better person. It's really kind of a self-help kind of concept of fantasy. And then I thought, oh, that's a little too self-help. And actually, the people who I think will enjoy this are people who already love fantasy. So, you know, they don't need the help. I was just trying to be more encouraging people to see fantasy as kind of more from a serious light or practical light, that actually fantasy isn't escapist, but it's actually very useful. It's a way of creatively dealing with real problems that you can apply to your life. And, you know, it's good for families, it's good for kids, it's good for old folks. It's, you know, really something that's often looked down on, I felt.
Complaint that some have is that it is removed from the real world, and so it doesn't deal with real world issues. And you kind of confront that in this book.
That's exactly what got me to write this, is there was recently a study that showed how much kids love to read fantasy. You know, there's a huge predominance over other types of books like, you know, mysteries and action adventure. You know, they love fantasy. And then kind of the predictable reportage on that was that, well, of course, because, you know, we're living in a scary world and kids naturally want to escape.
There are a lot of scary worlds in fantasy.
And of course there are. And those who write fantasy and those who read fantasy in any depth know that, you know, it's not an escapist form of fiction. It's all of the writers talk about trying to deal with issues that were actually very important, very complex, and that they found fantasy was a way to deal with kind of inner, intangible values in a way that made them tangible and so let people explore these creative storylines. And importantly, you not just go into fantasy, but you return from fantasy. Tolkien talked about three stages. You prepare yourself for wonder, you go into this wondrous world, and then you come back. And his point and others was that it's in the coming back that fantasy creates its meaning, where you've explored ideas in a way that's, you know, much more imaginative and creative and deal with things like, you know, right and wrong, good and bad, good and evil, you know, huge, huge issues that are actually the ones that do face us in the real world.
I think you make the point in here that fantasy is wonderful in the strictest sense of the word, like full of wonder.
Full of wonder, and that is, in a sense, kind of an ability. It's a creative, some have described as like it's a kind of muscle of the heart or the soul, something. The more you exercise it, the more capacity you have for it. And so there were a lot of people who were interested in spiritual ideas, C.S. Lewis, who saw fantasy as a way to develop people's powers of imagination and wonder in the sense of really awe and amazement in a way that would help them be more appreciative of the real world and how amazing it is too. Chesterton said in the fairy tale, the apple is golden, and when you come back, you realize how amazing it is that apples grow on trees and they're green and the rivers run with beautiful waters, and that's amazing too.
What are you getting at when you talk about spiritual depth? I mean, is this the idea that especially for the 12 titles that you feature, are they grappling with bigger questions than just good versus evil?
Yeah, their fantasy can be used to really address all sorts of issues or ideas. I started with a couple of books. There was one called Momo and another called Tuck Everlasting. Tuck Everlasting talks about the idea of what if you could be immortal? There's a spring in the woods that if, you know, you drank from it, you would become immortal. And it has this group of kind of backwoods folks, a family called the Tuck family. Unlike the vampires of today who are immortal and just, you know, ultra cool and sophisticated. And Tucks are kind of backwoods and they're just kind of stuck in being immortal.
Like backwoods ennui.
Yeah, and they, you know, their life just repeats. And at some point they say, you know, we're like rocks on the side of the road. Life is going by and here we sit. And so this author, Natalie Babbitt, who's, you know, won many major awards for literature, used this story to talk about the idea of, you know, what if you could? And so the protagonist in the story has to decide, does she want to drink from the spring? And so she makes a, you know, decision by the end of the book. So that's kind of a limit. It's not, you wouldn't call that good and evil, but it's exploring an intangible issue and making it very tangible in this book.
You also mentioned Momo, and I was hoping we could touch on that because it seems like the issue at the heart of it is kind of subtle, actually. It deals – and this is by an author who had a much better known book, the author of the Neverending Story, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, he's dealing with the use of time.
It deals with a lot of things, the use of time, everyday life, and how we use it. And it's a wonderful story of a young mysterious girl, kind of a Pippi Longstocking type. She lives on her own, just is a wonderful person. And her wondrous talent is listening, you know, which is magical in the way she does it. A very simple concept. But these folks, the gray men come to town and they offer to help people become more efficient. And the concept is I'll save all this time. And the gray men offered to bank it for them. And so they quickly turn the town into a bunch of hardworking people who no longer have any fun. They no longer have any art. They have no games. And so it's the children who look at this and try to figure out what to do about it. You know, there's kind of a Buddhist element to the story of every time and daily life and how we disconnect them or measure them in ways instead of just being here now. It's an amazing book, one very little known or read in the U.S. It's available in English translation.
And the author is?
Michael Endy.
Yeah.
There's a new English-American version out. And I said at some point I think I might have written this book just to get people to read Momo.
Well, and along the similar lines of this realization that children can take on things in a different way comes a book that many of us have read but maybe not thinking of it in those terms. The Little Prince by Antoine de Saint-Exupéry is one that you even point out at first blush kind of looks like a comic book.
Yeah, it's almost like a you know graphic novel kind of odd story. It's kind of you know surreal at parts, but it's also one of the most loved and most read books around the world. And he's a case where you know it's obviously a children's book, but it's not a children's book. You know, it's loved by adults. And
in a strange way, it's almost a memoir.
You know, he also was a pilot, and he wrote some wonderful books about flying and kind of the mystical aspects of flying. And so this is kind of about the mystical aspects of living. And it just has, you know, beautiful insight. And like a lot of these books, the point is that these are not children's or adults' books. Categorizing them isn't the point. That if it has a story that's useful to you, it's worth reading.
And you also raise a really interesting point that in the original French, the people that are sort of contrary to the Little Prince are just the big people. And we think of them when we read this in English as the adults. But the original version never makes that distinction.
Yeah, it kind of challenges us to think, have we gotten old? Have we just gotten bigger? And have we lost our childhood senses or are they part of us still? And fantasy authors, I think, tend to say, you still have this in you. You still have the child as part of you. You have fantasy and imagination as you grow up and that, you know, fantasy is a way to draw out these creative ideas again and get us to look at the world fresh and maybe come up with some fresh ways of dealing with it.
You wrote that you had thought at one point of including Winnie the Pooh in this book, but abandoned that idea in favor of one from a series featuring the Moomin Trolls. And the book you spotlight is Finn Family Moomin Troll, which I will concede is currently being read in the Tyke household at this very moment. And it's I will just by way of a preface say they are a unique group of creatures.
They're weird.
Better way to put it.
Yeah. Winnie the Pooh and his friends are kind of blithe, jaunty, free-spirited types, but it's all kind of mild-mannered, pleasant adventures, or Edwardian England kind of stuff. And the Moomin Trolls, you know, it's kind of an acquired taste. A lot of people haven't read those, but almost everyone who's read them really loves the stories. And it just occurred to me I wanted to do Winnie the Pooh, and then I thought, oh, Moomin Trolls are so much better because they're so much more reflective of the human condition in a kind of a richer, you know, both light and dark and just inclusive of all types of really odd, wonderfully odd character. I mean, they're just eccentric, but they're all very loving in their way, and they're all embraced in the central family, the Moomin Troll family. And they're wonderful stories, more magical, more mundane than Winnie the Pooh, but highly recommended.
The adventures are of maybe a more modest sense, and what really shows through is the eccentricities of the characters, but only, you know, the as you say, they're all really accepted by each other.
And, you know, interspersed with episodes of real magic, and it's a delightful group of stories. I recommend Moomin Trolls highly.
I imagine a lot of people look at the list of 12 books you feature and they say, wait a minute, where is Harry Potter? Why is Harry Potter or any of the books in that series not included in your list?
Where is Harry Potter? You know, I, of course, considered it, and I sort of passed on some of the big blockbuster, big series. The Lord of the Rings isn't here, but the thoughts that went into those books are here. I think I tended to pick briefer books that would be easier to pick up and read and, you know, be done with them. They happened to be 3/4 of them are children's books, but I didn't intend that. I was just looking for the best books that you could read to get this sense of the spiritual depth of fantasy. And then when you read Harry Potter or Lord of the Rings, you will see those elements in there. But they're often more hidden with all this action and activity that goes in the big stories.
But you are not necessarily steering people away from Lord of the Rings or from Harry Potter.
No, not at all. It's more just these are more kind of entryway drugs to make you realize why fantasy is chosen by all these amazing authors. I mean, these are some of the top authors in the world. Many of them wrote adult books that were highly regarded. So it's not just an off subgenre of easy to write fiction. Someone said that fantasy was the original fiction. It used to be all fiction was fantasy and had this mythological impact and significance. And, you know, maybe other fiction has gotten lighter while fantasy has kept its depth, is one way to say it.
Did you go back and reread all 12 of these books
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, love doing it. These are books that are easy, I mean, are meant to be reread. And I think C.S. Lewis said, you know, reading them the first time, it's kind of like wasting a fine wine on thirst. You really savor it in the second or third reading. So,
well, hopefully there will be plenty of people who listen to these and go back for a second or a third reading. Philip Martin, thanks so much.
Thanks, Mitch.
Milwaukee writer Philip Martin's latest book is called The Purpose of Fantasy, A Reader's Guide to 12 Selected Books with Good Values and Spiritual Depth, published by Crispin Books. We'll return with more of Lake Effect in just a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Before the break, we spoke with Philip Martin about his guide to 12 especially good fantasy books. One of the books Martin mentioned, Momo, features a character who is well-loved for her ability to listen. That is a trait that essayist George Burtis can appreciate.
Gave away my ears the other day. It was to a friend. No, he had two of his own, so it wasn't like a transplant. Anyway, while I was doing that, I also pretty much zipped shut my mouth. Mostly, I just sat there and listened to him. I do that periodically. It's called being a friend, bending an honest, generous ear to a friend in need almost defines friendship. This pal of mine needed to talk, to lift a few heavy thoughts off his mind, but more importantly, he also needed to be heard. Those problems gnawing at him were rooted in his heart. Doesn't too much matter what they were. This I do know, they were important to him. In a sense, they were a kind of story, his story, and he needed to have it validated, to know that it was valued and important because it was being heard. You see, he wasn't asking for advice. He just needed to ease those problems by rubbing the balm of another human being's attention on them. Being chosen for that chore is probably one of the highest compliments anyone can bestow on a friend. In effect, it says that that person trusts you, values your silent attention and respectful confidence. Those of you who've had the experience as either the giver or receiver know the reward. Thing is, there aren't many good ear lenders around. It takes a certain quality to be a good listener. The point is that although we all hear, too few of us truly listen. Hearing is an act of the body. Listening is an act of the soul. We have all these high-tech, newfangled hearing aids, but they just don't make listening aids. Being a good listener is a true gift, one that we share just by lending an ear to a friend. But in lending that gift to a friend, you also give a gift to yourself. There's this other thing about listening that I've come to understand. It's embodied in an old story out of the Depression era, not unlike the job shortage situation we're facing today. As the story goes, a room is filled with applicants for a job as a telegraph operator. A steady, humming flow of dots and dashes filled the room, but it was competing with an even heavier drone of conversation. At one point, the door opened, and in walked another applicant for the job. He stood there a minute, walked over to the door marked office, and knocked. A man opened it and said to everyone, "Okay, you can all leave. We have our applicant." Well, understandably, all the others were furious and demanded an explanation. The man gave it to them with one word, "Listen." When the room fell silent, what they finally heard in those dots and dashes repeated over and over was this message: "If you hear this, knock on the door. The job is yours." I think that's what being a good listener is all about, rising above the din of noise and listening close with mind and heart. One thing for sure, that will always get you the rewarding job of helping a good friend in need.
Essayist George Burtis divides his time between Wisconsin's North Woods and Milwaukee. Many of his essays first aired on WXPR in Rhinelander and on his blog, East of Eagle River. Listening is also at the heart of our series, The Islands of Milwaukee.
Welcome to The Islands of Milwaukee.
This is Maureen Towie from The Islands of Milwaukee. This week, we received answers to our questions of the day through our islands line and also through conversations at some of the meal sites run by our community partner, Interfaith. These meal sites are great community hubs where many seniors come for a warm meal and good company. So we asked them,
"What are the sounds of Milwaukee?
What are the sounds of the Milwaukee?
What are the sounds of Milwaukee?
The sound of the Milwaukee is music and the winter winds."
Okay, my sound is the garbage can truck in the morning time. Early in the morning when you sleep, they come and they bang and wake you up. That's my truck and my sound is.
I heard a cardinal up on the top of the tree right outside my neighbor's house. and I often hear chickadees. And because we live near St. Luke's, we hear sirens almost every day, several times a day.
All the bars and all the music and all the noise and all the racket, all the people.
The sounds are jets flying, buses going, cars driving, people walking, people coming together at picnics, on the beach, and especially at senior dining.
Thank you, Milwaukee, for sending us all of your sounds. If you or someone you know would like to answer our questions of the day, please call our Islands line. We love hearing from you, and each answer we receive helps us to build a more connected community. Until next week, thanks for listening.
You can participate in the Islands of Milwaukee project by calling the Islands hotline at 414-678-1653 or by visiting islandsofmilwaukee.org. That's the Monday edition of Lake Effect. Don't forget, you can learn more about the people who produce this program, read the full program guide, and get in touch with us, all from the convenience of your computer or your mobile device, just as long as that device is not a toaster. Find us online at WUWM.com. I'm Mitch Teich. Tomorrow on the show, a conversation with the retiring head of the Milwaukee-based A.O. Smith Corporation, plus an oral history of punk rock in Milwaukee. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I sure do hope you can be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.